Thank you, John. So we're talking about waking up from the sleep of this life, from the sleep of ordinary life, from the sleep of ordinary conceptual consciousness. So you see, from beginningless time we have slept in ignorance, that's what he's referring to. He says, it's time to wake up now, enough of this. Use everything, body, speech, and mind, to begin the process of waking up. Throughout your days, perform virtuous activities. And this might remind you of the second paramita that was listed earlier in here. Moral conduct is how it's classically translated, but it's doing no harm. As we focus on doing no harm, our perceptions of how much people are suffering seems to increase. Then you will begin to recall the realities of suffering and how everyone suffers, which is the fourth of the four contemplations you've been doing. Then you will see that we have no certainty of living even another day. It gets back to the truth of impermanence and the fact that the teachers for a long time have just been trying to get into our heads that we don't really have much time to waste. That this is, for most of us, not an instant process of recognition, it's a developmental process. And we want to work on it because we don't have all that much time to do so. So he goes on, just really stressing that the time and the opportunity are now. And this reminds me of a quote from his student, my teacher, who said that we're surrounded by opportunities for practice. In fact, especially the little things that get in our way, the little things that irritate us, little things we'd like to have out of our way. Those are actually the most precious opportunities to remind us and to bring us back and to watch our mind and to remember the practices. So why waste it? Throughout your days, carefully contemplate the reality of impermanence. Practice with joyful diligence, again, the fourth of the paramitas. And then when death comes, you'll be ready. And this is, he's talking from the experience of practitioners for thousands of years. For some reason, almost unnoticed, without being noticed, as one's perceptions are refined and as one's view increases, death loses, we lose our fear of death. It becomes just kind of a part of the natural rhythm of life. And there are stories that some of you have read already of practitioners in all lineages, in all religious traditions, who are reassuring their friends and followers as they die to not grieve, that they're really not going anywhere. So he stresses that when death comes, you'll be ready, you will not be afraid. If you don't have this kind of confidence at the time of death, what has been your life's purpose? He's really cutting to the chase here and making us uncomfortable. What have you taken refuge in during your lifetime? And he, in his teachings, would stress how we take refuge in possessions and in money and in all sorts of things that we desire, all of which are unreliable, as he would put it, sources of refuge. They don't last. They aren't there for us when we need them. So he's urging us to form an appreciation for and understanding of a more reliable path of wisdom. And then he gives us hints on conduct. Conduct is the other word for activity, view, meditation, and conduct, you'll hear. Review, meditation, and activity. So these little things he's saying here are the ways we train in the view, and we use it under the heading of view. We try to think about things differently. We try to perceive things in these ways, and then through our day, in our activity, we try to remind ourselves that the nature of everything is like the reflection of the moon on water. Or like bubbles on the water's surface, or dreams, or mirror images, or echoes, mirages, illusions, hallucinations. Everything is this way. It's important to remember he's not saying things don't exist. He's just saying that their ultimate nature is ineffable, can't be pinned down, is boundless. And my teacher actually had us go out to a stream for an hour or two, just sitting on the edge of the stream and watching water bubbles. And his instruction was to focus on a bubble and follow it. And it would go away. Another one would arise and focus and follow it. And he would have us do work with mirrors, looking at the mirror. It's a good way of understanding why the enduring sense of I, me, mine, an independent self, is an empty appearance. You can see this image in the mirror. It's an appearance. You could ask somebody, who's that? It's you, but it's not. It's an empty appearance of you. It's not really there. Or you can camp the mirror to look at the person next to you. Who's that? That's Linda. But it's not really Linda. It's an empty appearance of Linda. And we're encouraged to look at things that way, not denying their relative truth. Of course, it has a relative truth. Our rearview mirrors and our car keep us from crashes. But the absolute truth is that it's not a car in that. It's just a reflection, an appearance. And we're encouraged to work with these things in this paragraph in our formal practice as we try to understand view, and then in our daily activities, trying to remind ourselves to return to these kinds of viewpoints. Not denying the existence of things on a relative level, but appreciating that there's more, that there is this boundlessness. And he just had to slip that line in, that the nature of time is similar. You can play with that yourself. So I think that's enough of an explanation about it. If there are questions that you have about this, please do write them down and put them in the box. The previous page approaches this also in some quotations down at the bottom in bold print. We must undertake a process that begins with a conceptual understanding of egolessness. This is a way of saying selflessness or emptiness, but basically the best word is boundlessness. It's an appearance that isn't substantial, dreamlike. And then based on that understanding, as our understanding of this empty appearance of the boundless nature of things increases, our meditation and activity get richer and reinforce view more, and that's the developmental process. And that's what realization is called. Realization is already happening with every one of you as, you know, step by step, we start to understand a little bit more about what this is all about. And it's really absolutely simple. sounds weird because it's a different way of looking at things, but it's it ends up the experience of this as it grows is simpler than our ordinary perception is. So, normally at the beginning of a retreat, we have, in some traditions anyway, a practice of first refuge, taking refuge. And we've been doing that since we arrived last night. And following refuge practice, we go into the aspiration of bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is a Sanskrit word that means awakening mind. And so we, at the beginning of our practice, or in this case, we're doing it partway in, after looking at refuge, we're making the aspiration of bodhicitta, the aspiration of awakening mind, which is that we practice for the benefit of all beings. We practice to support each other in this sangha. Our practice affects each other and helps each other develop. And we practice for the benefit of all beings. And this has two benefits for self and other. It helps us to not grasp for our own enlightenment. If it's our own enlightenment, it's nothing close to enlightenment. It's just a grasping of a concept. What we're practicing for is to expand our awareness and our compassion so that our practice benefits all beings, and that's our aspiration. Let's sit in meditation now.
Do you mind if we had a 5-minute break?
Yes. I mean, no, I don't mind. We'll take a break. Is writing on joy and sorrow. Can you all hear me okay?
Yes.
Your joy is your sorrow unmasked. And the self-same well from which your laughter rises was oftentimes filled with your tears. And how else can it be? The deeper that sorrow carves into your being, the more joy you can contain. Is not the cup that holds your wine the very cup that was burned in the potter's fire? And is not the lute that soothes your spirit the very wood that was hollowed with knives? When you are joyous, look deep into your heart, and you shall find it is only that which has given you sorrow that is giving you joy. When you are sorrowful, look again in your heart, and you shall see that, in truth, you are weeping for that which has been your delight.
You read it again.
Mm-hmm. Your joy is your sorrow unmasked. And the self-same well from which your laughter rises was oftentimes filled with your tears. And how else can it be? The deeper that sorrow carves into your being, the more joy you can contain. Is not the cup that holds your wine the very cup that was burned in the potter's oven? And is not the lute that soothes your spirit the very wood that was hollowed out with knives? When you are joyous, look deep into your heart, and you shall find it is only that which has given you sorrow that has given you joy, that is giving you joy. When you are sorrowful, look again in your heart, and you shall see that in truth you are weeping for that which has been your delight.
Good night. Pleasant dreams.
Time change.
Time change.